Everybody, please welcome Doug. He's going to do steps 4 to 9. Welcome, Doug.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Doug Rowell, and I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful. Grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is just to irritate the newcomers. I don't know if it does. Made me mad, man, when I heard it. You know, first time I heard somebody say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. Now, I'm a figure outer. You know that figure outer? You say something and I figure out what you mean. The first time that I heard somebody say, I am a grateful alcoholic, I started working on it. Because I know that they don't mean I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. That's too dumb. This guy is an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic who is incidentally grateful that he got his driver's license back. He's an alcoholic who happens to be grateful that he didn't lose his job. This guy is an alcoholic who's grateful that he got to keep his family. Of course, that makes sense. The guy's an alcoholic who is incidentally grateful he got his driver's license back so he could drive to his stupid grateful job and support his grateful damn family. And because he couldn't possibly mean that he's grateful to be an alcoholic, he's like, oh, I'm just so delighted to have this disease, which the only way I can arrest it is just not to ever swallow another drop of alcohol. Yippee! You know? So it's like, no, okay, I figured that out. So that what I did was I missed the next 10 minutes of everything that was said. So that's why I wanted to clear this up. When I say I'm a grateful alcoholic, I mean I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. For a number of reasons. One, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I couldn't be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. The place I wasn't going to fit, the only place I ever fit in my life, only place I ever fit in my life. I didn't even fit in my own family. I shared one time at a meeting. My mother went with me one time to a meeting where I was speaking around her house, a local meeting there, and I said that I didn't come from a dysfunctional family, as I know a lot of alcoholics do. And my mother said to me on the way home, you shouldn't tell those people that you didn't come from a dysfunctional family. And I said, do you think it was dysfunctional? She said, it was okay after you left. So Clancy's right. It's a disease of perception. And I'm grateful to be an alcoholic because my life at 16 years and 3 months sober, I believe, is better than it would have been had I not been an alcoholic. I mean, if I had been an alcoholic who didn't get sober, I may not be alive now. Of course, I'd be grateful for that. But I believe that my life today is better being an alcoholic, having been an alcoholic, having been a drunk, having hurt everybody who ever cared about me, thrown away everything of value that I had, coming in here missing teeth, walking with a limp, you know, and just not having anything worth having. And I thought my life was over when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe today that my life is better because I'm an alcoholic than it would have been if I wasn't an alcoholic. You couldn't have told me that when I was new. And there's another reason. I mean, if I'm not an alcoholic, what the hell is wrong with me? You know what I mean? Something ain't right. And I believe that because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're here to talk about today, my life is better than it would have been. And I certainly would not have taken the steps. I didn't want to take the steps when I got sober. I tried to avoid them for a little while, because it didn't seem necessary. It seemed like a lot of work that really didn't apply to me. In fact, I look at these steps. In my first meeting, I saw the steps. And even though I was sort of offended by all the talk of God and power greater than yourself and spirituality, I was kind of impressed with the gist of the thing. And I thought I knew some people who could really benefit from that, from those steps. And I understand that this convention, this gathering, is called Sporado Stefna. Is that right? Did I say it right? I'm trying to pick up Icelandic phrases, you know, so I can go home and impress people. I learned to say Takfir Mig, thank you for the meal, and that's about. Oh yeah, and Thor taught me one. Well, I thought he taught me one the other night. I thought he was saying, I'm going home, I live close to here, which was Abodasmalas. So I'm trying to, Abodasmalas. And what he was saying was, I bought a small house not far from here. And so but I'm still going to use that one when I go home, because no one at home will know. I'll Abodasmalas, you know. They say, man, that Doug has a gift for languages, doesn't he? But I understand that Sporado Stefna means step convention. This is a step convention. This is what, whether I pronounce it correctly or not, this is a step convention. And I'm so glad to be part of a step convention. I'm not actually thrilled about conducting a workshop on 4 through 9. These are work steps, and I'm going to tell my sponsor when I go home that I conducted this workshop, and he'll laugh for some time. He'll laugh for quite a while. As my sponsor, Clint H., is well known for conducting step workshops, and he's really quite good at it. He's only been my sponsor since November, and I've been sober for 16 years. In my first 5 years of sobriety, I went through the steps 1 through 12, 3 times. And so I had some experience there. And during the time between 5 and 16, I took other people through the steps. And so I sort of like if I hired on as a guide through Africa, though I have never been there. And that's not exactly true, but that's the way Clint would put it. And step four, before I go on, I really want to thank the committee for asking me here, the people, I'm so impressed, we all are, with the AA people in Iceland, that it's fresh. And there's, don't misunderstand, there's a lot of excited and exciting people in AA in the United States and around the world. But to see the level of excitement and interest, and as Karen mentioned earlier, to see the room full for a step study, you generally don't see that at conventions in the States. People will show up for the main speakers, and they'll go out and socialize during the step studies, if there are step studies, and that's okay. That's Alcoholics Anonymous too. But it's exciting. It's exciting to come here and see so many people who are interested, who are hungry for this thing. Hungry for this thing is really, and so I'm delighted to be a part of it. And I want to thank all the people. Sigi was picked us up when we arrived, and is sort of instrumented a lot of the things that we've been able to do here. And of course Sola, who emailed me and has been took us to her house for dinner, and cook for us, and she's a spotlight. You know, she's a lighthouse of this thing. You look at her, and it makes you happy to see her happiness. Now, that's the kind of faces that I like to see in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and yesterday Thor took us on a trip around the Golden Circle, and got to see all these all this great part of your country, and of course Ellie, and I mean I shouldn't have started naming names, because I'm going to leave out important names who I should have thanked, but I'm just so grateful to be a part of this. Now, step four. Step four is the one where people, it's the bogging down. It's where people, because maybe they've done step one, maybe they've done step two. I don't know. We know, I know when I did it, step two, I could not have done. It was done for me. It was done for me as a result of saying, God, if you're there, please help me. God took me to a place where step two was done for me and I could notice it. That's the only way I could have done it. Other people come in here, there's only, I won't go into a long thing about step two. There's only two premises. One is that I'm insane and one that there's a power greater than myself. I couldn't accept, I didn't have any trouble with the insane part. It was just that I didn't recognize any power greater than myself. And that's necessary to get to step three. You're not going to turn your will and your life over to something you don't understand. In fact, you can't understand it. It was told to me, I said to a man, how can I turn my life over to something I don't even understand? And he said, Doug, he's one of these old timers, you know, it's like comfortable all the time. And he said, Doug, you don't have to understand the infinite. It's not a requirement of step three. And, you know, you don't have to understand the infinite. Wow, that's a relief. So when I got to step, I did step three with my sponsor. My sponsor was a year and a half sober when I came here. And I didn't know until we finished step three. And I said, okay, I'm going to do my inventory now. And my sponsor, Jim, said, I can't help you with that. I haven't done an inventory. He had been a year and a half sober and he hadn't done it. But he's the one who told me, if you can't read a page, if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. Read that book every day. He took me on panels to prison. He got me to meetings, men's meetings and mixed meetings and speaker meetings and book study meetings. He was a good sponsor, but he hadn't done the steps and he couldn't take me through the steps. And he said, and he told me that. He didn't try to take me where he couldn't go. And he said to me, you're going to have to find somebody else to do those steps with. If you want to get another sponsor, I'm okay with that. Don't worry about me. And I decided not to get another sponsor. I like Jim as a sponsor, but I went to other people for help. And there was a guy in my home group at San Fernando in the Los Angeles area who was 20 years sober. He was a great big Irish guy named Stan Mahoney. He's dead now. I guess it's okay to break anonymity after they die, you know, unless they didn't want anybody to know they were an alcoholic. Too bad, you're dead. So, but Stan was a great big guy, and he was a tough guy. He rode motorcycles. He was a machinist. He was a special effects guy for films, and he worked at Universal Pictures, and he did intricate machining, and I respected everything I knew about Stan. And he was 20 years sober. And I went to him and I said, my sponsor hasn't done the steps and I need to do an inventory. Will you help me with it? And he said, absolutely. Gave me his phone number. And so I read the book and I read the 12 and 12 and saw what it had to say. And I called Stan and I said, okay, I'm ready to do my fourth step. And he said, you mean your fifth step? And I said, no, I haven't done the fourth step. I want to do the fourth step. And he said, okay, do that and then call me. I said, well, I need help with it. And because I thought I had heard people say they went over to their sponsor's house and did their fourth step. And Stan said, okay, you do your fourth step and then call me and we'll get together and we'll do your fifth step. And I said, no, Stan, I don't know what to do. And he said, the directions are in the book. And he almost hung up on me. I said, wait, whoa, Stan. I read the book. I read the big book, and I read the 12 and 12, and I don't understand how to do it. I don't know what to do. And he said, the directions are in there. I said, but I need to come over, and you can walk me through this and show me what to do and guide me through it. And he said, Doug, I can't do your goddamn inventory for you. God. So I said, well, I don't understand it. And he said, the directions are in the book. He said, did you ever work on an engine? Okay, now he's talking my language. Yeah, I'm a motorcycle guy. He's a motorcycle guy. He's a machinist. I've taken engines apart. I said, yeah. And he said, did you use a motor manual? I said, yes. And he said, okay, did you read the motor manual, then put it up on the shelf, and then go take the engine apart? No. And he said, okay, that's what we do here. You open your motor manual that says take a half-inch wrench, take the carburetor off. You do that, then you go back to the book, and it says, take a Phillips head screwdriver, unfasten these fittings. And I was getting the picture. Okay, he said, that's what you do. You read a little bit, you do what it says, then you read it some more, then you do what it says, and you'll get through it. And that's exactly what happened. It's exactly what happened. I went through, I followed the book. In fact, I think it's interesting that I think of step four as the first action step. In fact, in the 12 and 12, it says this is the first step where there's tangible evidence that we did anything. And yet it's still in how it works. The next chapter after that is called Into Action. Evidently, Bill didn't even consider this action, you know, but we do. It's tough for me. Step five is a lot more difficult for some people, but step four was real difficult for me. I was looking forward to step five. I opened it and opened the book, and it talked about resentments. We put our resentments down on paper where we were angry at. It says we were angry, and being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what defeated us, and we considered its common manifestation. So evidently, the whole problem, and it says this in various ways in the big book. The whole problem was me. You know, my ego, myself, was the problem. However it manifested itself, and it says we were mentally and physically ill as well as spiritually sick, and in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So we're supposed to look at our resentments in chapter four, things we resented. And I started out. I saw this form over here on my first inventory. I think we all see that when we get our first big book. Alcoholics are people who look for pictures, you know, and look through the book and we see this little form over here. I assume it's the same way in the Icelandic book, where this, all of a sudden it's a chart. You know, it's almost the closest thing we have to a picture, and we see that. And and you know, Mr. Brown, he paid attention to my wife, and this other woman wanted her husband to put the house in her name. You know, and my wife wants me to do, you know, all these resentments, and I didn't exactly understand that form, but I started writing about resentments. I wrote, I don't really have very many resentments. A couple of people that. People I've worked for, this guy, I sort of read a little bit about him, you know, and then I do resent my grandmother. I resent my grandmother, the Pentecostal minister, because every time I wanted some help, she told me to pray. Pray. Wow, pray, Doug, just turn it over to God, Doug. My mother... God love her. I found out in Texas you can say anything about anybody if you follow it with God love them. My mother wanted the best for me, but there were times she felt sorry because I wasn't eating right, you know, and so she would cook all these meals and freeze them, and they were like balanced meals, and put them in an ice chest and bring them to my house. In Hollywood, 50 miles away from where she lived, buy you some food, you know, put these in your freezer, and then you can microwave them when you're hungry. You know, it's a mom's job. It's not a mom's job to provide food so her son can spend the food money on cocaine. But I couldn't explain that to her, so I would say, thank you. And talk for the mig. And I would say, you know, so, but after I got sober, I realized she stood in the way between me and my bottom. And I kind of resented that. I would have hit bottom a lot sooner, so I put her on the list. I have a daughter who was born when I was on the road with hair, and her name is Starshine. She can't help it. Her parents were hippies. I love my daughter. I was crazy about my daughter. My daughter went to private school. When her mother and I broke up, I agreed to take care of her medical expenses and put her and keep her in private school all of her school career, so I had to get a job, and I couldn't follow my acting career. And people would say, "How are you doing? You going out for any parts?" No, you know, I really have to keep my job because, you know, stars in school, and I have to take care. I resented Star a little bit because she stood in the way of my acting career. I knew I shouldn't, but I was trying to be honest here. And then I realized I had friends who had three kids. They lived at home. They didn't live with their mom somewhere. They lived at home, and my friends went out for parts. They got things. They held down a job, too, and they would get a job where they could go out for parts, and they got their careers going. But it's hard. You know, it's real hard doing that career. So it's great to have an excuse. I got to keep my daughter in school, you know, so least I could do is give up my acting career, which was kind of hard anyway. And so I started to realize these things. But the biggest resentment I had, this one was legitimate, I wrote a musical comedy. I wrote all the music. I wrote the script. And I got some people together who I knew, some musical people, and we put together this production of a low-budget production, and we got producers in. We got money people in to look at this thing. And we recorded all the music, all 14 songs, and we had it all on tape. And I got it on. Somebody picked up the option. They had it under option for a year and a half, and it looked like this show was going to go to Broadway. And then they kind of fell apart, and the option people decided they didn't want to hold the option any money, and they let it go. And so I owned the show again. And somebody came to me who was associated with Davy Jones from the Monkees and said, I think this would be a good show for Davy Jones. Can I borrow the music and take it and try to pitch it as a show? So I said, sure. I gave him all these three reel-to-reel tapes that I had and said, here, yeah, oh, great, Davy Jones would be terrific. And the guy took it, and long story short, which is too late, he lost the tapes. He lost the recorded music. This was years before I got sober. But when I actually did my fifth step, it came up when I did my other little resentments and I don't really resent people very much. Oh, but this guy lost my music, you know. And Stan said, now I don't know anything about the music business, but is that the way it's usually done? Is somebody wants to hear the music and you give them the only recorded copies you have? Okay, you don't understand. This guy was a professional. He was associated with Davy Jones, okay? If you can't trust him with the only copies that will... But shouldn't you make another copy? Okay, I'm not talking about my copies. I'm talking about... I wanted to, you know... And it became really clear what my part in it is. Get into that more in the fifth step. But so I wrote down my resentments, and I wrote down... And you know... In the resentments, I really didn't have a lot of resentments that weren't resolved when I got sober. I resented the government for taxing me. Okay, everybody has that problem, you know, get over it. I actually quit paying taxes for a while, and I found out that's not good. They have time. They have all the time in the world. When I got sober, I owed $168,000 in back taxes. Not when I got sober, but by the time I was about 4 years sober and the interest and penalties had acquired and accumulated. And I said, can we do a compromise on this? I can pay you part of what it's worth. They said, nah, you're young. And we'll be here. So, in this resentment list, it says, referring to our list again, it goes back to the list of resentments that we had. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done us, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And to me, this is something that, okay, we have resentments, fears, and sex relations are the three categories in inventory. And I have to say that in my case, in the case of a lot of people that I've worked with, I owed amends. I hurt people. I injured people that I had no resentment against, I had no fear of, and I had never had sex with. Now, plenty of people that I did have sex with were injured as well, but that was just that was just some position that we were trying that night. You know, it wasn't the okay. That didn't translate well. you know, but all of these things. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And in another part in the next page, regarding our sex conduct, it said, where had we been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Where had we allowed our ego to stand in the way of us being good citizens, of us being good friends, of us being good relatives, good fathers, good children, good parents, good spouses? Where had I allowed my ego? And I think that's what I needed to look at in here. And these three categories, this may be heresy. It would be in some areas of California to say that the big book, as it's laid out, resentment, fear, and sex didn't cover everything I needed to have in my inventory. It certainly covered a lot. You know, I thought my sex inventory was going to be huge because I had been a little rock star for a few years, and I had also been a cocaine dealer for a few years, and consequently, because of those two positions, I had had a lot of sex. And I told that to Stan when I did my fifth step. You know, I did this, and I did that, and I did that. And then he said, well, I don't know, you just seem like a red-blooded American boy to me. You just had a couple of good jobs. And so, you know, I mean, he made it simple. Stan made a lot of things clear to me. I looked at my fears, and you know, my fear at that time when I was newly sober was the same. The primary fear was the same fear I have now, looking bad. I tell you, I didn't want to do this workshop. I would much rather call my sponsor and say, look, I will pay your way to Iceland. Come and do this workshop because these people need to have a good, fourth through nine workshop. And the reason is not because I don't know about the steps. It's because I don't want to look bad. And looking bad is my greatest fear. It was when I got here, it is now, and it probably will be tomorrow. And that is my greatest fear. Scott Redmond pointed out to me, he's not dead, but I broke his anonymity too. And pointed out to me that fear is subjective. And I said, well, yeah, I suppose everybody's afraid of different things. And he said, no, the things that we're afraid of right now, we both talk about being afraid of looking bad, of not looking, being cool. But if you're walking through a dark alley and three young, strong men come up to you and want your money, your fear changes. Your primary fear becomes what's going to happen to me right now. You know, so it is subjective. But most of the time, my greatest fear is just not looking good. You know, that's why I was kidding last night about not asking questions, but the truth is, I'd rather not ask questions, unless I think asking question will make me look good. I can think of a smart enough question. So that's, my fears were simple, and my sex relations were simple, and my resentments were simple. But before I got them on paper, they seemed very complicated, very complicated. And I poured my heart out to this guy Stan, and it took about an hour and a half, maybe. We sat in a car in the parking lot of the San Fernando Group, and we got done, and he said, what did you leave out? And I looked at it, and I thought, now there were some things that I came across later that I realized I had left out, and I dealt with them later. But at the time, that was the most I could do. It was everything I could remember that I thought I needed to put in my inventory. And Stan said, well, let's pray about it. And I thought, this is the answer. This is the one where I'm going to get that God shot, and I'm going to feel joyous and free. And Stan said, God, we thank you for this fellowship and our sobriety. Please help me and Doug to stay sober, to see your will for us, and give us the power to carry it out. Let's go to that noon meeting. What do you say? You know, and and that was it. And the fact is, I did start to feel happy, joyous, and free. I wasn't that much different, and I was very grateful to Stan. Now, the fact is, a few days later, I was hearing Stan share, and he said something about gay people that I thought that's kind of cold, you know, it's kind of intolerant, I thought. And then I started listening to the man share, and it became obvious to me that Stan Mahoney, dead Stan Mahoney, is a racist, a sexist, and a homophobe. I'm not only none of those things, I have taken stands, I've marched against people who thought that way, and I just bared my soul to this asshole. And I went to the old-timer of our group, a woman named Ruth, who was just focused, spiritually focused all the time, and I said, Ruthie, I told her what I did. I did my fifth step with Stan, and she said, oh, that's good, Doug. I said, you know, he's a sexist, he's a racist, he's a homophobe, and she said, yeah, we all know that about Stan. I bared my soul to him. And she said, Doug, don't put people in AA on a pedestal. Don't ever do that. There's no room to dance up there. And I cherished that thought because Ruth's concern was not with me for bearing my soul to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I should have done. And Stan was fine, was a great... Stan may have been the perfect person to hear it because I respected him when I went into that car with him. And what she was concerned with was Stan would have no room to dance, you know? And that's what I get concerned with now. Every once in a while, I do this thing and people think I bring some kind of light to the room. I know that I'm not a light. The best I'll ever be is a window. If I'm doing my job, I'm a window. If I got the window clean and the drapes open and God's light can come through, that's the best I can ever do. But people will put you on a pedestal if they think you know something sometimes, and there's no room to dance up there. You know, we're all here because we're not all there. You know that I mean? We're you know. When I have taken people through fifth steps, and as I said, I've gone through the step process four times in my sobriety, and there are people who have had a lot rougher lives than I have had. I came from an upper middle class family who was not an alcoholic family. I didn't have a bad childhood. It was long. It was like 42 years, you know, but it wasn't wasn't bad. And but I've heard some fifth steps where people just ruined children. People who were abused mentally and physically and sexually, where you just want to cry. You want to go, oh, God, you should drink, you know. Oh, my God. And I have asked for guidance. And there was a guy that I sponsored and I took through this process, and that was all I could do to keep from bursting out in tears. In fact, thinking of it now, it's all I can do. And he said, he kind of joked about it. And I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, how can he joke about this? And I said, this is some serious stuff, you know. Yeah, I know, you know, because I... And I said, it's not funny. This is a resentment. This is worth resenting. And he said, yeah, and it turns out, as we talked about it, he thought that at 7 years old, he had done something to cause this. His father and his father's sister, his aunt, sexually abused him for years. And he thought that because it was a sexual thing and some of it actually felt good to him. Of course, that's sex feels good, even if you're being abused and taken advantage of sometimes. And he thought that he had done something to cause it. And he didn't want to look at his part in it. And I was able... not through anything that I know, because it was so far out of my experience, but just because I had prayed for guidance and said, you didn't cause this. You have some blame in this, but it's not anything you caused. The only blame you need to address is that you are holding on to this resentment, and the resentment will block your sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what you need to work on, letting go. You don't need to look at what you did to cause this. And I don't know where that came from. I didn't know I knew that. and I said it to him, and he realized it. And that's what we do around here. We tell each other more than we know. And it gets us well. You know, I wanted to actually spend some time on 6 and 7 because I wanted you to understand that there's only a couple of paragraphs in here on 6 and 7, and they're very, very important. But I used up a lot of my time. And so I just tell you, they're very important. Father Ed Dowling told Bill Wilson, step 6 is the step that separates the men from the boys. He recognized the significance of step 6. When I was new, I used to joke about step 6. I would say, I wasn't even sober yet, and I'd say, I'm on step 6. So girls would say, oh, wow, that's impressive. And I'd say, I haven't done 4 and 5 yet, but I'm ready to let them go, you know. Yeah, I'm ready to let them defects go. And also, I don't know if you'll hear this up here. I hope you don't. People will say, I know people in Los Angeles who will go to great lengths to explain to you the difference between character defects and shortcomings. In 6, it calls it character defects, and in 7, it calls it shortcomings. However, in the book, I like it in the book, they mix them up. They call it character defects in 7. In fact, the 7-step prayer says, where is that darn prayer? Well, there's a good prayer in here about... about step 7, and it says, "My Creator, I want that you should have all of me, the good and the bad, and the good and the bad." And then it says, "Take away from me every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows." So, in the 7-step prayer, it uses defect of character, and in the step itself, it says shortcoming. There's no difference. Bill Wilson said there's no difference. People would ask him, "What's the difference?" He said, "I was a new writer. I didn't want to use the same word twice in the same, you know." But there are people who go for the words. You may have heard some of them speak, who will tell you about the words, and that's why I like to talk about the music. The words are very confusing to me. But we have to be ready to let these defects go, and we identify them in our 4th step, and we talk about them, discuss them, let them go in our 5th step, and we're ready to have God remove them in the 6th step, and in the 7th step, we humbly ask him to remove them. In the original text, it said, humbly on our knees. Ask. It didn't say this is what we did. It said this is what you better do. In the original text, it said, humbly on your knees, ask God to remove your shortcomings. And my sponsor points out that we do humbly ask. We humbly ask. He said, when you're on your knees, you have to be humble. And it's hard to get in a fight. This fight we saw last night, if one of those guys had gotten on their knees, the fight would have been over. You know, it's hard to say, hey, what the hell do you think you're doing when you're down on your knees? And so it's a good way to humble yourself. And that's the way I start out every day, on my knees, saying, thanks for another day. Help me to see your will for me. Give me the power to carry it out. Then go out and screw something up. I want to talk about the 9th step. I want to talk about my experience with the 9th step, because I had a number of experiences of making amends, and some where I went to people and said, I owe you money. I worked for the American Broadcasting Company for 7 years. I stole from them. One time I built a box to steal a TV, and I built a box with wheels on it. I stole the wood. I stole the wheels. I stole the time to build it. I stole the television. I put it in the box, locked it all up, whirled it out to my truck like it was a toolbox, and stole it. When I got sober, I was sober a little while, and I went to the company, went to the guy who fired me. He didn't fire me for that. He fired me for some other stuff. And I said, I told him what I did. And he figured it all out, and he said, I figure you owe us about $850. And I said, okay, can I make payments? And he said, here's the deal. He said, it'd be hard for me to get the money back in the system. I could do it. But what I'd like to do, I've been hearing some good things about you. If I ever hear of you taking a drink again, I'm going to go after you through your union, and I will make you pay this money back. Other than that, sign this paper that says you owe it. I'll put it in my drawer, and if you don't ever drink again, you don't owe us a dime. So that was the deal. So I signed the paper, and I thought that was kind of interesting, and I can't drink. But when I was 2 years sober, I said to my father, I owe you some money. I had borrowed money from my father, $1,500 here, you know, $800 here, you know, and I paid some of it back. I borrowed money, I paid him back, borrowed money, paid him back, and the debt was increasing. And I figured I must owe him about $2,000 or $3,000. And when I was 2 years sober, I went to my, I was going to save up the money and just give it to him. Here's your $3,000, you know. And he would say, well, that's more than I borrowed. That's all right, keep the change, call it interest, you know. Yeah, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never got around to saving up the money. In fact, I've never met anybody that actually did that. Yes, I met one guy who said that he did it, and he probably did, but that's one out of millions. So I went to my dad when I was 2 years sober, and I said, I owe you some money, and I want to pay it back. At 2 years sober, my dad said to me, don't worry about that money. I don't need it. I don't want it. All your mom and I ever wanted was for you to be happy. Look at you. Look at your life. I was with a woman that I loved and loved me. We were both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my relationship back with my daughter, who I had hurt so many times that she was afraid to be around me, and that was patched up, and my life was good. And my dad said, "I just look at your life. You know, that's enough payment." And I said, "That's fine for you. But we have this step in our steps that says I have to pay back money that I have to make amends for injuries that I caused, and I think borrowing money, not paying it back, is an injury. Or I might get drunk." And my dad said, "Oh, okay, I didn't know. I didn't know what the, okay, well, I don't want you to get drunk. Fine, pay me back." I said, "I don't know how much I owe you. Do you know?" And he said, "Yeah, I got it in the computer." Yeah. Don't need it, don't want it. I just like to look at it sometimes. And so he sent me an itemized bill of everything I had borrowed and everything I paid back, and the balance was $7,200. So it was good that I didn't hand him the $3,000 like a big shot. You know, here's your money. Well, you're about $4,000 short, you know. So what I did, I started sending my dad a check every Friday. Every Friday without fail. I sent him a check and a note, because I had heard Sharon B., who is still alive, share that that she had done that with her father. A check and a note. So every Friday I sent my dad a check and a note. That, you know, sometimes it was a joke. Sometimes it was what I was doing. Sometimes it was a how are you. Sometimes it was just I love you. But always, because this is not the bank. This is my father. I can't just send him a check and an envelope. I included a note. Sometimes it's just a post-it stuck to the check. But after about 3 years, my dad called me. He said, "I just got your check." And I said, "Oh, good." Well, and he said, "Did you know how much you owe me?" And I said, "No, I don't. Should I know?" And he said, "You owe me $32. 3 years. And I had almost wiped out that debt. And I said, I didn't realize. And so we met for dinner. And I gave him his $32. And he gave me a little closeout notice that he had printed. And sure enough, I had paid the debt off. And we had dinner. And you know what? I let my father pay for dinner that night. My father always said, "I'll pay for the dinner." He always said that. You know, let me get this done. And I would argue with him. "No, Dad, I'm a grown man. Let me buy dinner." "No, no, that's a father's job." I didn't hear that part. "Come on, Dad, let me buy dinner." You know, and what I didn't realize what I was doing was saying, "I owe you all this money. Let me pay for dinner at least." I didn't realize that. We don't know the baggage that we're carrying until we set it down. And once I had that debt paid off, my father said, "I'll pay for dinner." And I heard him saying, "That's a father's job." I could let him do what he thought was his job without feeling guilty about it. I didn't know that. And my father died a few years ago, and I was going through some of his files with my mother, some financial things, and I found a file in his cabinet that said Doug, and I pulled it out, and thinking it was my inheritance. And and it was. It was. What it was all these notes that I sent him. It was like 150 notes. I opened this thing up and all these notes fell out. Post-its and little pieces of paper and stuff. I knew immediately what it was, and I was shocked because they were like trash to me. I mean, you know, things you'd read, "Oh, that's nice," and throw away. And he had saved all of them. And my mother was there, and I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "Did you know that he saved these notes?" She said, "Yeah. Oh, yeah. He cherished those notes. He would get your check, and he'd open the envelope, put the check in his pocket, cash the checks, and he'd read the note to me, and then he'd lay it on the dining room table. And then through the week, he'd sometimes come and he'd pick up the note and he'd smile and lay it back down. And then when the next one came, he'd do the same thing and put the other one in the file. And I never knew he did that. He never told me. And she said, one time I said to him, "You know, Doug sure loves you." And he said, "I know. I got it in his own handwriting." This is a gift. I believe that I really have come to believe that every single step in our 12 steps comes with a personalized gift from God. Sometimes it's real small and we don't even notice it. Maybe other people do, maybe they don't. Sometimes it's real big, like my father saying from the grave, "Thank you, I know you love me. I never would have had that if I hadn't had to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to save my life. They were not attractive to me when I came in here because I could not have seen the life that I would have as a result of taking these steps." And if you're new, just do them. You don't have to know why. Just do them. That's all I have. Thanks for letting me share.